Hello, and welcome to episode 446 of The Crate and Crowbar, being recorded on a sweltering 2nd of May, 2025. My God, it's hot.
It's
so hot.
You
don't have your camera on, but I am rewarding you with the image of my sweaty face in my equally sweaty conservatory, which is just, in the winter, a place where all the cold in the world gathers to decide on its next sort of assault. And where in anything past about April, it's just the hottest room in the universe as well. So that is where I'm calling you from. How you doing, Tom? How's things?
Yeah, good, thank you. I'm sparing you my visit over the cam this week, ostensibly because it's probably, hopefully, fingers crossed, the first time my microphone will be probably working for the last few episodes. And so hopefully that's all squared away. And also, yeah, I'm melting like a giant ice lolly. And the first hint of warmth in the UK is always, we basically live in a swamp. As soon as it turns to summer and it gets vaguely warm, we just live in a swamp for 2 weeks and everyone gets very grumpy. So hopefully that grumpiness will not translate to our hot takes this week.
It's been hot for like a couple of days and it rained.
That's all it takes.
Rained briefly earlier. And I literally went outside and did a whole like Shawshank Redemption moment at staring up at the sky because I just
sank your knees and just splay your arms out.
Absolutely. I cannot cope. Well, should we talk a little bit about Old Skies and perhaps point and click games generally a little bit?
Yeah.
So Old Skies is the new game from Wadja Eye Games. They are the studio who have kind of been holding the sort of candle torch for relatively traditional point-and-click adventure games, kind of in the lineage of sort of Broken Sword, I guess, in terms of, you know, some of their tonal references. I encountered them relatively recently with the previous game to Old Skies, which was called Unavowed, which I think you've played as well, right?
Yes,
I have. Which I think is for me was a real wonderful surprise. Like that game is excellent. It has a really brilliant premise, which is basically like wizard detectives, which it does like a really really good take on. And I would say that game is characterized by like a real dedication to character.
Yeah,
a kind of discarding of a lot of the kind of trappings of point and click adventures that, you know, have kind of made the genre a little bit of a laughing stock in recent years. You know, the puzzles tend to be quite modestly designed in terms of like what you need to do. There's not like none of that like combined custard with dragon sperm or whatever stuff that you would get on the old ones from the 90s. And just a kind of a slightly more adult kind of take on the genre, not in the creepy sense, but in a kind of, you know, they feel like relatively grown-up games without being at all kind of po-faced or humorless. Unavowed was kind of campy in its own way because it has all these wizards and genies and demons and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I do think that game, you know, we'll come on to Old Skies, I do think that game is a little bit ahead of Old Skies in terms of its kind of opening moments and initial premise. It's just much more hooky. It's got much more of a kind of a premise to it in terms of who you are in this world and what you need to do. Whereas Old Sky is a little bit more of a slow burn, I think. They've been making it for years and years and years. You know, it was a very long production process, I think. And it kind of shows because I keep thinking I'm sort of getting close to the end of it. And actually, you know, I looked up how many chapters there are and I'm only a little bit more than half way through. You play as so the basic premise of the game is and it's like a really, I don't know if you agree with this, Tom, but I think the fiction of it and the science fiction kind of world building of it is really, it's just really well kind of paced and well arranged in terms of what information it gives you and how it onboards you into this world. You play as Fia. She is the member of a kind of future agency who can be commissioned to essentially use time travel to go back in time and do various things. You save someone from dying or, you know, prevent someone from meeting someone else or changing the details of a business deal. There's a few examples of the kind of missions that you do in the game. And so you play as her and you're often accompanying someone back to a period in history where you will have a kind of usually just a handful of locations, four or five, maybe at the most, in each time period, in which to, you know, enact whatever the client's kind of wishes are. And this brings you into all sorts of kind of unusual worlds and allows you to have a kind of episodic structure, which is maybe the thing that makes it feel a little bit more slight than Avowed, at the start. But I was very pleased to see that actually as the game goes on, it does deepen quite considerably. You know, in those early kind of couple of chapters, I was a little bit worried that it was going to end up being a little bit too slight. But actually, it's very clever about making everything that it tells you and all the information it gives you about its world and its characters pay off in some way further down the line. And yeah, how are you finding it, Tom?
Yeah, so I'm probably about halfway to two-thirds of the way through the second chapter. So, yeah. And as you say, like, it very much drops you into a job, like your job. And one of the fun things about it that I really like about it is that, so time travel is just a fact of this world. Time travel has been invented. It's a corporate product, and people who pay enough can even revive people or save people's lives in the past in order to keep them in the timeline, because everyone, according to their algorithm, has been assigned a rank, which is one of the many cool little sci-fi concepts that the premise affords. So if you live your life just like as a teacher, and you know, obviously you're affecting people's lives, but you might be ranked low compared to someone who has invented life-saving medicine that elongates the lives of people by 20 years on average across the globe. So you'd be ranked very high, and that kind of affects who you can talk to, who you can mess with. It also is the source of all the stakes so far in the game in terms of like what you can and can't manipulate. Very interesting premise for an adventure game or a puzzle game. But one of the things I really like about it, and one of the things I really like about Wadjet Eye games generally, and Avowed as well, is that it's very good at concentrating the decisions you can make. Like, it always like contracts your choices. So you're not, for me, I'm never in the state where I'm combining everything with everything else. I have a million things, which is a trap that loads of adventure games fall into, because I'm in a different time period. And one of your most useful devices is you can basically call back to the present. You've got like a handler, and they've got a database in front of them. You've got your own database of history. So you can search history for what's going on around you. And when you get names, you can tap that in as in a database, and that gives you clues that lets you solve puzzles and also moves the story forwards. Very elegant. Also, very constrained, because you only have the names that you've encountered in that particular time period in the two or three scenes that you've been in. And then when you go to a new time period, that's reset. So it keeps your kind of options very limited and very kind of like structured in a way that lots of adventure games, particularly older ones, don't, where you end up with like an inventory full of yarn and smelly substances and a bottle cap. And yes. Like,
you end up rubber chicken with a pulley in it, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And these games, like, it's true of Unavowed as well, like, it's very concentrated, and therefore it makes much more room for the story, makes much more room for the characters. I actually think it's quietly a very nice sci-fi game. Like, it's the way that your camaraderie with your companions, with your your people who work with you, I think it's Chronozon, is that what it's called?
Something like that, yeah.
So yeah, the company you work at that basically does all the time travel products that you serve to your clients, they're pretty cool. I actually really like the very, very first scene. And I don't. So it introduced the concept that throughout, that if you're this sort of agent that just travels through time, and time is constantly being slightly altered, but not like in a global game changing, life destroying way, it means that you can't follow sport because certain teams just don't exist, or they might just. And it doesn't matter, because like a team cannot exist, and it, according to the game, it just won't affect the way the world works. The shop fronts change between periods whenever you come back home, because the shops are just always shifting because some go out of business and they're considered low priority. So yeah, they might just phase in and phase out. There's there's an interesting sort of like, they don't like hit you over the head with it. It's just sort of a background hum of like stuff just becomes unimportant and you're unmoored in time in a way, in a series of very sort of small everyday ways that is like, I think, quite a cool idea actually, and I've not seen it anywhere else actually.
No, I was going to say exactly the same thing. It's really clever because the agent that you play and your colleagues are essentially, they wear these bracelets that fix them in their own like timeline, in their own kind of consciousness, while everything else changes around them. So they talk about like being specially selected for their ability to kind of disconnect from things because things are going to change. And they worry about forming, you know, lasting relationships with people because they might just be kind of glitched out of existence, which happens constantly. They don't get it. Yeah, they don't watch TV shows because they're worried the TV show will just be glitched out of existence too. And actually that becomes, as the game goes on, no spoilers, but like that becomes the kind of central theme of the game, right? Which is the idea of like time travel being this agent of loneliness for these people, because in order to do this work, they have to remain unattached. But of course, they can't help being drawn to people and drawn to the clients and drawn to these intensely personal, stories that they're working with. It's like of great expense to do this. So the people you're working with are often doing something, you know, for a final chance at something that they missed or a missed opportunity. And that gives it a really unique charge to everything, you know, even though, you know, it's quite a funny game. It's also very, very earnest, and the people's emotions are very real. And this is the thing that's kind of really kind of taken me under its spell as I've played further and further into it, in that it's kind of a slow burn, but it pulls you in really, really effectively. And as the game goes on, there is this kind of building momentum of characters who recur or recur in kind of separate forms due to the kind of timeline of it. And a central character who is just fascinating. She's someone who, you know, as I said, has been kind of chosen, is sort of specifically skilled in not kind of forming connections, but can't help but kind of be drawn to certain people. And just that kind of, that's an interesting story. And like, again, like something I can't think of another example of anything quite like that. She's brilliantly voiced as well. And the game pretty much top to bottom is brilliantly voiced. It's very characterful, and quite bold with its kind of characterizations. But I think it uses that quite cleverly to kind of go like, oh, this guy like seems like a kind of, you know, big shot executive type, but then it'll find a twist on that, or it'll find some kind of way to undercut that in some sort of way.
Yeah. I think it's quite illuminating that one of the first choices you get to make is like, once you leave the very first environment, the first interaction, is that you get a choice whether you want to go to the office or you want to go back home. Mm-hmm. And you've not been to either location. So I went back home and there's nothing in her apartment. You mouse over the window, which looks out over the cityscape, and she's like, I don't even know what these buildings are, because, I mean, they just change every time we come back. There's a screen where you can read your emails, but there's just, like, jobs in there, nothing else. And there's a bed, and there's nothing else. And she's like, I don't want to go to sleep yet, I'm not tired. There's nothing to do there. And as my first introduction to the game, I was like, well, why is this here? What's this for, then? That's just like, you sent me to a place, because I'm in adventure game mode. I'm looking for, oh, there must be a paperclip or something that I will have to bend into a certain shape to take it to a different location and solve a really weird puzzle. But no, it's not. It's like, you just got to leave and go somewhere else. it tells you a lot about fear. It's like, she doesn't have she doesn't have a home, like that consists of anything meaningful. And actually, kind of one of the things I'm getting so far from the game is that all those little things that are considered algorithmically unimportant are actually the stuff of life, of existing, like dumb stuff that, like sports teams and local shops and people walking around, even just like colleagues or people a couple of streets down blipping in and out of existence. That is kind of the stuff of life that is missing from fears and life. And so, like, yeah, I thought that was quite effective already. And she's not like monologuing about this. It's just a thing that is there.
Yeah, I know. It's really well delivered, and it doesn't kind of hit you over the head with anything. It is a slow burn. and but to kind of realize that actually that's a really effective way to kind of deliver a very kind of cyberpunky central premise, really, about, you know, this being a kind of an exercise in depersonalization, you know. And actually the kind of the procedural nature of it is to a point, you know, to a character point and to an emotional point, as well as to a kind of gameplay one, as well as supplying you with, you know, a bunch of puzzles to solve. It's also giving you the kind of keys to understand this character from quite a sort of rich level, where you feel really, really motivated to kind of find out what's going to happen to them, you know.
Yeah, and I do think that the adventure game format, like particularly this, is quite an old school, old fashioned kind of adventure game format. I would say you've got an inventory, you're pointing, you're clicking, you're mousing over things to see what you can interact with. This is like just a very kind of from the 90s, late 90s onwards, that type of adventure game. I think it shows that even though it's very long in the tooth, that that genre is very good at storytelling and jokes. It's very good at jokes. It's always been very, very good at jokes.
Yeah.
And it's very good at atmosphere, because I think that the puzzles are kind of, for me, have often been the worst part of those games, especially when they've been deliberately too obtuse. Mm. They're not in this game. I think they're nicely pitched. But actually, it's in the kind of interactive book kind of zone, I still think it has loads of value.
Well, yeah, and also just on the puzzles in this game, I think they are just like, I mean, it's hard to tell from anyone else's like perspective, but I remember when I was talking about that game a couple of years ago with Marsh, Cocoon, you know, that game made by veterans of Playdead, and like how the level of friction in that game is just like exquisite. It's just amazing. Like, you will complete that game if you play it, you know, because it's so clever at cueing you to make the logical jumps. That they're still satisfying, you still feel clever, but you're never frustrated. Or the moments of frustration are very brief. And like, so far in this game, I haven't used a walkthrough or a guide once, which is insane for a point-and-click adventure. and, like, so many of the puzzles I've just really enjoyed solving them, because the logistical leaps you need to make are probably pretty simple, but the way that they're laid out and the way that you have to kind of follow leads, you know, between locations and occasionally through different time periods, is just like deeply satisfying, because the play spaces are pretty small for each story. And often they'll shut things down, you know, subtly in order to kind of, you know, close off things that are not necessary for you, but although they do that very elegantly, it doesn't feel like that. You're never feeling like, yeah, you're overwhelmed with the amount of shit you have in your inventory. Everything's quite small. It even does things where, like, you know, in one mission later on, there's like a list of clues that someone's written for themselves to remind themselves of their password, and your major goal for this first part of this particular chapter is to find out what each of those clues refers to. But you can scroll down through that list and it will just tell you if this is something you should already know or whether it's something you need to wait a little bit in order to find out. And just by doing that, it just makes it so much less stressful. You know, it was so often the case in adventure games in years gone by where you'd be like, you know, have I missed something like hours ago, or is it something, you know, that's in my future at some point? And this game just does a really good job of removing that anxiety from the space.
Yeah, Unavowed is also very good at this, in that both games, they famously, the old adventure games had like tips line and hints lines that you could call for money to get like hints, you know, to get around a certain puzzle. There are entities in both of those games that you can just talk to get a clue. So in this game, you can just call up your guy in the present over a magic phone and ask him what he thinks about the current situation. He'll drop a little clue. In Unavowed, you're traveling with a companion, which is a really cool thing about that game, that this one is kind of slightly different. You're always with someone so far because you've got your client, but it's slightly different. So in Unavowed, the companions that you choose to take with you through each act, they are basically part of your inventory. They have got their own skills, they've also got their own perspectives on things, and that is a dimension that I really love about Avowed, so it's a bit different in this one. But nonetheless, like, you can, there's always someone to talk to about the situation you're in who can drop a little hint. There's not too spoilery, but can like push you on a little bit. It's a really nice little cushion, I think, for this type of game.
Yeah, I'm excited for you to play the rest of it, because one thing I think this game does really well is build on the ideas that they introduce and kind of find clever and delightful ways to kind of twist them around and change things. So, like, there's one mechanic, which I don't think is a spoiler to mention, which is if your character ever dies, there is a protocol by which you will be rewound to a few minutes earlier in order to prevent that from happening. And you get, that means you get these lovely little puzzle sections, which are very much like the sword combat from the first Monkey Island game, you know, how appropriate, you fight like a cow, where there are these little puzzles which you kind of replay over and over again in order to get your kind of desired response. And they're often, yeah, quite silly and quite funny and playful in how you go about that, you know.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so those are really fun, and again, as the game goes on, like, they keep finding ways to twist that formula and change things up and find kind of jokes and things like that to make about it. So yeah, I'm still a couple of chapters from the end, hopefully going to finish it in over the weekend, and we'll report back next time we talk on how I think it all plays out. But yeah, I think it's a game that's like grown in my estimation as I've been playing it, basically, from going like, oh, this is like a really solid game, to actually, this is telling a story which is really, really rich and unusual, kind of anywhere, really. So yeah,
it has that thing as well, time travel, in my experience, in most sort of like passive kind of television, something you absorb passively, like TV shows and films and stuff, often very irritating. As a video game device, time travel is amazing. Like, in many genres, there, it gives you so much leeway. In this game, it uses it just to change environments, to just like fling you back a couple of centuries. There's a really cool device that you hold above your head and it zaps you into the period dress for the time. Absolutely love that. That's really fun. And the clients you're taking with you, they love it as well. Like, it's very exciting. Everyone's excited about what's happening.
Yes.
Which is very encouraging and really pushes things forwards. And yeah, just even stuff, you know, time traveling, Braid and bullet time in games. I think time is just a great thing to mess with. It uses as a great storytelling device in this as well, as we described with the sort of malaise of it in the background.
Well, yeah, and being able to do that thing that, Michael York, you know, Basil Exposition does in the second Austin Powers movie, where Austin asks him, like, what about all these ridiculous paradoxes that I could encounter? And he just tells him not to worry about it and try and enjoy himself, yeah. You know. And yeah, they turn to the audience and say, and that goes for you too, you know. which is certainly true of, you know, most time travel stories have to find a way to kind of do that right, to kind of, you know, stop themselves becoming ludicrously, you know, the grandfather paradox is all over this game, and they do address it.
Yeah.
But there's a real lightness and intelligence with how they address it. You know, we're not in the movie Primer. We're in a world that has really, like, clearly worked out rules about how this thing works. And actually, the kind of unintentional consequences of those things is, as we've discussed, is like a really clever plot point. It's the kind of thematic heart of the game. So, like, yeah, like, huge points for that, really.
Yeah.
And they do, there is quite, you know, you probably won't have encountered many of them yet, but there are, like, you know, puzzles that involve going backwards and forwards between, you know, different time versions of the same event, like a couple of months later or on one mission.
Oh, cool.
And on one excellent mission later, a few minutes earlier, before the kind of, before you play through a kind of whole scenario and you think it's over, and then you go back to a few moments before you first played it. And there's all stuff like that, which is super playful and clever.
Yeah. Before I encountered the second client, I'd read a random clipping that was just completely optional, just in a journal somewhere. I just happened to look at it, that mentioned their situation, the fight game that, so they're in, like, the boxing game in a particular period. And I was familiar with her name before I even met her. Like, and that was kind of absorbed through just stuff being around. Yeah. Everything that's placed in the world is very well placed, and it's worth reading stuff because it pays off So far, everything's very deliberate, and that's a very nice, reassuring kind of design for an adventure game, where you really don't feel like you're wasting anything; you're just absorbing, and some of it will come back, and there's that little spark of recognition. Oh, yeah, I know who that is. Very good.
Because I was
world building.
Yeah, because I was thinking about adventure games generally, and thinking we could have a chat about them because they're kind of interesting things. I put a little message on our. On our planning Discord for all the Crit and Crowbar people and kind of asking them, you know, what their faves were. And, you know, from Marsh talked about like Sam and Max, really enjoying that. And he said Max is just a horrid little monster and the game is gleefully psychotic, which I think is very true. Lots of people talking about Day of the Tentacle. Graham, again, talking about Monkey Island and Sam and Max too.
Yeah.
But they're interesting games, right? Because I wonder if they're like best experience in childhood. Like, I don't know how likely it is that I am going to like ever play Monkey Island 1 or 2 again. Like, the thought of doing that is like, oh, there's going to be a lot of walking around. There's going to be a lot of traversal, and there's going to be a lot of going through like, you know, joyfully written, but like pretty enormous, like dialogue trees. You know, it's like, you know, I love those games and like I will often return to them in some shape or form. But like, I do wonder about like, they have this really weird reputation where everyone thinks about them so fondly, but also people think about their faults and their idiosyncrasies with real intensity as well, you know. So yeah, I was just wondering how you felt about that kind of whole stuff, because, you know, I think me and you are more or less exactly the same age, and like, it's true that like the early adventure games, the LucasArts one in particular, they were the best looking games, they were the best written games, they had narratives and stories which were way, way, way ahead of kind of anything else, and that, you know, that gave them such a privileged position. But they were kind of, you know, they were fraught with problems in terms of their playability as well, weren't they?
Yeah, also just it's severely limited in the interactivity in terms of you can only click on one thing and then click on another thing at any given point. Like moving around the environment was not, for the most part, apart from some pretty horrible timing puzzles in some of those games, not a factor. It was very much just kind of like, trying to solve a puzzle to get to the next sort of chapter of the short story you're reading, really. Like, but admittedly, there was some great art in those games that really stuck with me. And I think like it was more just like I thought of them as sort of very vivid short story books. But when we were sort of like, we were chatting about like some of our favorites and kind of putting together like a little list of some of our favorite adventure games. The list I put together, absolutely soaked with nostalgia. Can't get away from it. Like, honestly, like, I find it very difficult to break away from that. Not that anyone should, really. Like, if you should take pleasure in those memories and things like that. But in terms of, like, actually analysing them as you know, how sophisticated the interactions are, they're not very sophisticated. It's pretty basic stuff. A lot of the logic backing up those puzzles was just nonsensical and just demanded you to read the minds of the developers. And that was just basically, at the time was fine because there wasn't the same pushback that you'd get for such a thing today. Whereas I think like in terms of puzzle design in puzzle games across the board, like developers have way more player feedback. I think that many, many years, you know, decades of experience seeing what has worked and what has not worked. And games are generally, you talk about Cocoon, which is a wordless, I suppose it's a puzzle game, you'd call it now, but like it's similar principles to an adventure game. Like you're clicking your beetle into a place and zooming out, doing something else, and zooming back in. And like it's just a very much more advanced and better organized and a beautifully elaborate and elegant type of puzzle solving compared to these games, these old games in particular, which were not, but they were very much worlds. Like they like, it felt like playing old adventure games. I stuck my head into a world and then came out of it.
Yeah,
when I sort of logged off.
I think that's very, very true. And like, I was just thinking, like, maybe one of the reasons that they're so evocative for us all is that they're, because they had these like world states which were kind of relaxed, right? Where you could hang around in a location or a series of locations basically as long as you wanted, and exhaust everything that was there without, like, you know, Tetris, the block appears at the top of the screen and there's nothing you can do to stop it from falling to the bottom, you know. Whereas, you know, an adventure game in that model is the block appears at the top of the screen and you can just wander around it and examine it from every inch and talk to it about, you know, do like a long monologue where you just do jokes on the how much wood would a woodchuck chuck for, like, you know, like 20 lines of dialogue, as I remember you can do in Monkey Island, you know. And it's like, I think there's something to that. That was a kind of unique aspect, because games generally existed on a, you know, on a level of jeopardy, on a level of like something moving you forward, something stopping you from just sort of hanging around. Whereas those, you know, LucasArts games in particular, they just like, they let you hang out in this world for as long as you wanted. And there was even that sense in those games that when you got to a point where you were going to move on from a particular location to another, or, you know, leave a particular zone of the game between an act or going to a different island in one of the Monkey Island games, there was almost like, or maybe this was just me, like a sense of loss of doing that, because it wasn't an era in which you could like necessarily have a whole bunch of save games going where you could easily backtrack in these things. You may have just had one save disc that you use for Monkey Island, which only had space on it for one save. You know, you couldn't jump around in these games. And I think that's one of the aspects of them that does make them so evocative is perhaps that sense of almost like an open world vibe where you can take things in at your ease and kind of play in this kind of fictional space, rather than being kind of driven through it with, you know, all guns blazing Doom style, you know.
They had really strong editorial voices, like almost authorial voices, in terms of the nature of the humor in each given one, or the nature of how characters spoke. There was definitely kind of literary influences directly often with the Discworld games, from like classic science fiction tales in games like The Dig, which I loved. So you were kind of interacting with those books. I was interacted with those books I'd read and loved as a kid as well, really, as much as anything else. So you could talk to the wizards in Discworld, or you could talk to people in Ankh-Morpork in Discworld Noir, and actually, or just in the Blade Runner game, you could retire replicants or talk to replicants and decide if you're a replicant or not, and all of that kind of stuff. It was like, it was a way to actually kind of interact. You know, often, sometimes, when you watch a great film, it's an amazing world, and it's like the film ends and it's gone. Often these games are a way for it to just continue and for it to become something more, and for you to go back and be able to repeat it without being forced to just look at the same thing over and over again in the same way.
Yeah, and like particularly the LucasArts games would find ways to like almost tease you to kind of exhaust all the dialogue of something. You know, they would like fill the game with information, you know, entire libraries that you could look through with stupid joke titles of the books, or long, you know, conversations that go nowhere about nothing in particular, you know, all that sort of stuff. They were kind of in conversation with the players in that sort of sense. Yeah, it's funny because for me, I think the games of Tim Schafer in particular, he kind of held a unique place in video gaming, particularly through the sort of, I don't know, the 90s, I guess, with Dirt Tentacle, Full Throttle, which for me was a pretty transformative game. Like, that was the first game I remember playing which felt like, wow, this is like an interactive movie or something. You know, the production, you know, the production level of it was so gorgeous. And the voice acting, it was one of the first games I think I owned which was like fully voiced. And it had all these wonderful kind of cutscenes and this like really specific world with this really specific aesthetic, which just didn't really exist on the same level of kind of authorial authority, I guess, anywhere else that I could see in the kind of game space. And I found those like a really immersive experience, Full Throttle, and then Grim Fandango, which I know you've put at the top of your list. I've chatted a couple of places about my experiences with Grim Fandango, because the end of Grim Fandango is like my central like video game loving origin story, really, which is I made the stupid mistake of going to university in London, which you should never do. It's a miserable, lonely experience. And I kind of had lost sort of touch with games. And all I had was like a really shitty like Windows laptop, which I was using to not write my essays, and a copy of Grim Fandango, which would at that point in time was already a good 4 or 5 years old. But I had it on disc. So this was an unpatched copy of Grim Fandango, which anyone in there will tell you is a really cursed object. It's terrible. Yeah. Like, it didn't really run at all. But it was all I had. It was all I could afford. And it was the only game I was playing for like a whole year of my university course off and on. And the ending of that game just completely fucking blew my mind, right? Because I was so miserable. I was so lonely. I like just felt like I didn't have any friends. And like, the moment where I realized that I was going to miss the characters in that game was just like, I'd never really felt anything like that sort of before or since, to be honest. It was just in a case of the kind of right game at the right time. And it's so funny that that game is really flawed in so many ways, but it has this sort of magic to it in terms of how unique it is, the kind of the world building of it, the kind of rules of the world, everything about it is so like perfectly pitched and delivered that like it still kind of remains. I mean, everyone says this, don't they? But it's still sort of death knell for the genre itself, but also the high kind of watermark of it too at the same time.
I think essentially, like on paper, it's a pastiche of lots of different films.
Mm.
The locations you go to, the character archetypes, if you were to sort of like write them all down on paper in a couple of like 20 words a piece, you'd be like, oh, well, this is just so-and-so from Casablanca. This is the Casablanca bit. This is the, this other film. To actually interact with all those characters means that you actually go beyond those scenes in Casablanca. So you're working as Manny Calavera, and you're a salesman essentially who is supposed to sell death packages to people who have just died. You sell them packages that will get them to heaven faster or wherever they're going faster, and if they can't afford it, then you can sell them just a long horror trek through purgatory. And that's kind of like part of your job. Soul destroying is part of the point.
You can get across the land of the dead in minutes if you've led a virtuous life, and you can get on the train and it just takes you across in minutes. But if not, you run the risk of having to walk across, which can take years, and you run the risk of being turned into flowers along the way, which is this game's version of like true death.
Which is game. Incredibly, like, actually horrifying. It's
really frightening,
me.
Yeah.
It's actually genuinely really scary. And the villain in this, is Hector, is genuinely really scary as well. All the characters are based on kind of Mexican Day of the Dead dolls, which is just an extraordinary way to inject character and a particular look into a game that only has so many polygons and 2D backgrounds that it can use. But also, just sometimes the best idea is just collisions of different like archetypes. So throwing Mexican Day of the Dead, colliding it with yuppie culture in 80s America, and that's your starting point at the top of a skyscraper as a salesman, kind of like Wall Street banker type in a sharp suit, and you put your Grim Reaper vestment on to reap the souls of the newly dead and try to sell them packages, and you complain about it being itchy, and then when you go into the real world, it is an absolutely kind of abstract nightmare. It's just endlessly creative and inventive. And you might meet like a Spanish revolutionary, and she isn't just a caricature, because you get to keep on talking to her. like past the scene. You get the cool scene where you're in a underground and with your flashlights, and you want to subvert the system, you want to break this whole thing wide open. But then you get to chat with her afterwards, and she's just bored of all this, and maybe like. Yeah, she's kind of like, she thought she'd do bigger things. This seems exciting for now, but maybe she was moving to something else. Like, you get that extra stage of this interaction with all these characters that goes beyond the archetypes, that goes beyond the stereotypes. And that is where a lot of the fun is had with games like this, which kind of ram loads of ideas and cliches into each other. And it somehow emerges as a just really memorable, fantastic experience. In spite of some of the most horrendous puzzles in all of the adventure games, there's an awful bit where there are just like flaming gophers, and there's a bit in a forest where you have to plant a signpost in the ground, and it rotates and points to where you're supposed to dig something up, and it's so precise. God, finicky, it's absolutely awful. Yeah,
awful, yeah.
Yeah, it's unbelievably bad. Like, yeah. And there is a director's cut to be made of that game where you just sort of like clear that stuff out.
Yeah,
it has been remastered, so it does work on modern systems. There are modern versions you can buy, but it's one of the few games where even if you have the walkthrough for an adventure game, this adventure game, parts of it are just very irritating to do. Which is a terrible shame, because the rest of it is fantastic. And also, I've never desired a game or a TV series of it. It's just it needs to exist as this type of interactive adventure game. This is how it should be, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it is the quality and the cleverness and the creativity of one of the best Pixar movies, right, in terms of its like world building. I think they actually did a movie quite recently which kind of had some ancestry with it, right? They had was it called Soul? I haven't seen it, but I heard good things.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing Hector shoot people with a gun that turns them into flowers.
So let's look at your list here.
Yes,
you got number five. You got June 1992.
Yes, so this is sort of an adventure game.
I
think it should be counted as one, really. So you're basically moving between the teachers of June. You're talking to the Fremen, and then you're talking to people in the palace. There's not a huge amount of like mega puzzle solving. There's kind of a strategy over layer level where you kind of like point characters in different directions. It's not hugely interactive. It's very, very atmospheric. Fantastic music. And I wouldn't say that it really sort of captures the depth of June as a novel. But as a game, as an Amiga game at the time, it was absolutely mind-blowing. It's astonishing what they managed to do with their less than a megabyte of memory or whatever they had, you know. Really, really evocative stuff. Like fantastic kind of character models, or just 2D sprite art, really. And just like even splendid bits where you're surfing around on a sandworm. Even that was like, I had this parallax kind of scrolling back and forth that looked almost 3D. It wasn't, of course. It was, yeah, just extremely evocative and very formative, like growing up. Cause I read June really young, was really excited by it. And then playing the game was kind of, like I said before, just going past the scenes that you've read and going a bit further into it.
So I think for all of your choices, I'm going to offer a kind of complimentary counterpoint to them. So for your June 1992, I'm going to go for the game that the same team made afterwards, which is a game I doubt you've played. I'd be very impressed if you have. A game called Lost Eden. You ever played Lost Eden?
No, I don't think I have.
I have no idea how this game ended up in my house in the 90s. But Lost Eden was one of those kind of sort of an FMV type game, but with kind of like very strong point and click vibes. It basically took place in a world where humans and dinosaurs coexist. You are like the chosen one or whatever, and you have to kind of go around and recruit all of these various anthropomorphic dinosaur tribes to come and like join your army. It had some very mid-90s like pre-rendered CGI.
Amazing.
Some cool cutscenes, very, very beautiful music. No idea who did that. Someone called Stefan Beek, who is just, I can just see, is just the person who did the music for all of the Cryo Interactive games, so June and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it was one of those games where like it was like almost like Myst, but with a kind of sort of RTS kind of vibe to it too, because you were sort of moving across a grid trying to find sort of secrets. And it was just fucking, like, to my 10-year-old mind, it was just mysterious as fucking balls, basically.
Nice.
Like,
yeah, that's
it was awesome. Just so strange to be kind of wandering around this completely unreal space, talking to these complete, like, freaky, like, pterodactyl weirdos. And, like,
oh,
yeah.
That's great.
I have a real soft spot for the kind of bargain bin FMV, but not so much the kind of, like, dumbass Fox Hunt ones, but there was quite a few, like, earnest ones back then that I, like, really enjoyed. There was one for the movie Congo, obviously one of the greatest movies of all time, but there was, like, an FMV game that came along with that, which was kind of, you know, there was some complexity to it, you know, it had some stuff going on. Yeah. So yeah, that's my counterpoint to June. What they did next, Lost Eden.
Lost Eden. You have reminded me that there was a Rama game based on the Arthur C. Clarke Rama. I think it was multiple books, actually. Have you heard of Rama, Jamie's? It's kind of a sci-fi staple.
Don't think I've heard of Rama, actually. That might be a blind spot for me.
Yeah, Rama is like a cylindrical vessel that humanity finds drifting. Like a few years ago, you might have seen in the news, a cigar-shaped thing cruising through our system, and people are like, oh, is this aliens? I think a lot of them were thinking of Rama. It's basically that shape. And humans board it, and it turns out to be some kind of zoo of loads of different alien species that are kept there. And they made an adventure game out of it. Puzzles are some of the worst puzzles I've ever played in a game ever. But in terms of it was incredibly exciting to go from bit to bit and see the new weird alien wildlife and figure out how to interact with it, what it ate, how to manipulate it. Really exciting stuff, just that sort of sense of discovery that adventure games are very good at.
Yeah, around the same time there was the I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream game as well, which is I think Night Diver remastering or about to remaster, and it'll be really good when that comes out, because I played that a couple of years ago and it's great. I mean, it's completely fucked up. It has, like, extended sequences which deal with the Holocaust, which is kind of
wow.
A lot. But actually, if my memory serves, they do a pretty good job of not making that awful and actually making that kind of, you know, to a point and to something interesting. Because I don't know if you've read the book. It's a very quick read, but it's a really bleak read. recommend that one. Your number four is The Dig. God, this was one of the best demos I ever played back in the early 90s. What a fucking demo that was. I don't think I ever played the full game, but The Dig, where you're Steven Spielberg's foray into video games, where you're a bunch of miserable astronauts up on a planet somewhere.
Yep. It's absolutely splendid. It's splendid, like, first of all, because you've landed on a planet and you're discovering loads of really cool alien technology that's, like, really organic and weird. And also, secondly, because almost immediately your crew gets split up and everyone goes a bit weird. And that is essentially what it's all about, is meeting your disparate crewmates and seeing how they change and how you change in response to your environment. And it's kind of, it's got all of that lovely kind of bubbling. Horror is too strong, but it's just kind of, it's kind of unsettling. It's an unsettling game throughout, about the idea that you can figure out the technology around you and you can essentially ostensibly solve puzzles and master the place, but you're gonna come back wrong afterwards.
Yeah, it's very much, it's like very powerful. Baby's first cosmic horror, isn't it?
And yeah.
It's the first time I ever encountered a lot of those themes, and I remember finding it absolutely terrifying at the time. You know, I think I ran and got my dad to come and watch one of the cutscenes with me because it was freaking me out so much.
Yeah, it's kind of you could also sort of slightly trust no one. There's like, you sort of have some friends and stuff, and then you might, again, it's like, it's weird to say, I'm afraid of spoiling a game that's like under 25 years old or whatever, but I'm pretty sure this the good thing is, like, a lot of these games are available to play through, like, DOSBox and stuff. Like, emulators have been really good at preserving these in playable states, and I'm pretty sure you can't buy them anymore, so I don't know, check the laws in your local area about downloading those things. But yeah, I found that, again, you're right, it is sort of baby's first cosmic horror, but you've got to have a first cosmic horror.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, if you were playing video games in the 90s, like, that was how you encountered so many of these things, right? With through,
right? Yeah. As a, if like adventure games could just be on ramps into further fiction that you're going to enjoy for the rest of your life, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool legacy.
My counterpoint to this is Beneath a Steel Sky.
Which
is obviously a classic, another Amiga classic. Again, that game was just so like top to bottom packed with like stuff. What a world to spend time in, you know, and what like a clever premise. It was Dave Gibbons, wasn't it? The artist of Watchmen who did all the, is that his name, Dave Gibbons? I got that right. Who did all the like art design for it and the character design. And it's this very like beautiful space that you're in, which again was like, my first experience of a lot of like, you know, transhuman ideas and like, you know, what if you could live forever inside a machine ideas and all that kind of stuff. It was pleasingly adult as well. And yeah, just again, a real classic. I can hear your cat likes it as well.
Sorry, I was hoping you wouldn't be able to hear him. But he's, so I'm on the second floor of my house and he's just vaulted up through, I don't know how he's done this, through the top floor window.
He's glitched and then in.
Started wailing. So I'm just going to quickly push him out.
Go ahead.
God, good thoughts. Yeah, Beneath the Steel Sky. You know what? I don't know why I didn't put it on because it occurred to me, like I have such kind of like clear visions in my mind of the environments, the background environments in those games. Mm. And actually, when I first like even started trying to experiment with coding and making games, the first thing I did was draw adventure game backgrounds. Mm. I basically wanted to make adventure games. And it was basically like, I just basically copied Beneath the Steel Sky because they're so evocative and like quite beautiful, even though they're obviously of dystopian futuristic cityscapes and stuff like that. But I got super obsessed with that when like a time to when I watched Akira and a lot of the kind of industrial futuristic manga
first puzzle in Beneath a Steel Sky where you pull a steel bar out of a wall which causes a guard to come up and see what you're up to, and you step out onto a kind of outside level and hang on the back of the door, and he thinks you've jumped. And then you come back in again. That's the first thing that happens in that
game. He's just like, yep, that's like, fine. Everything checks out here. It's just an everyday occurrence in this world.
Number three, Blade Runner. Now, this game can go fuck itself, right?
Because this game is actually broken, I admit.
Because the video game press, which I'm holding you personally accountable for, they hyped up this game so hard for so long, right?
I love it.
To the point where it was just impossible not to buy it. And I bought it. And this was a game they advertised as like having basically its own inner life. They were like, you know, this game will basically just run whatever you do. You don't even have to play it. You know, this story is going to happen. These characters are real. Which wasn't true. But, you know, it was a very beautiful game. It certainly like is as a tribute and a kind of repurposing of the Blade Runner world. It certainly does some exquisite stuff. But my version of it just broke after one character ran off screen and there was no way of fixing it. There was literally no way of fixing it. I couldn't patch it. I couldn't change it. I couldn't restart the game because I could restart the game from the beginning, play it the whole way through, and then the same thing would happen each and every time. So it was one of those like 90s PC games where I was like, well, that was a waste of like, you know, 6 months worth of pocket money. I just this game was just locked me out of playing past a certain point for like God knows why. I just didn't like the 486 or whatever. But Blade Runner. Explain yourself.
Look, it's completely fair as well for me to explain myself. I remember I was having a coffee with PC Gamers at the time, just a straight up adventure game expert, Richard Cobbett, the writer of many fantastic features for us, and now writes adventure games, I think, and writes for Fail Better and other places. And I was like, Richard, I really like Blade Runner. And he was like, you're a fan sist and just a world. A wild maverick of like, he didn't say that. It was like, how? Why would you like this game? Which is like, the puzzles are actually just kind of is busted in lots of different ways. Mm. So I did put it on here because nonetheless, I absolutely adored it because it does this thing where it splices the actual, I was obsessed with Blade Runner just as the film, but it splices the actual footage from the film into interactive scenes, and it kind of fulfilled a fantasy of what I kind of really wanted to do with the film. So a particular example is Deckard, who's this cop who has to hunt down replicants who are androids who have gone rogue, as the plot of Blade Runner, and you are a Blade Runner. You're not Deckard. There's kind of a couple of sideways codex references to Deckard's situation, but it's a separate parallel plot in the same universe. But you go into the police station, and the pan down shot is like FMV from Blade Runner, then turns into a scene with the police boss from Blade Runner, and then but you're there too, and then you get the mission from him, and you do go through all of those motions, and it feels like you're actually just stepping in. It felt to me like you're stepping into the film, you're stepping into the world in a way that was just, for me, extraordinary. And perhaps has not aged well, because that's maybe less desirable now, but at the time, like, that is exactly what I wanted to do with that world. Like, I wanted to go in, I wanted to eat the noodles.
Man, those fucking noodles, they look so delicious.
I know.
I wanted watching the movie Blade Runner.
I wanted to go to the animal market where all the animals are fake, and kind of like check up some IDs. I wanted to kind of like go to the cryo vats where they grow organs and interview people, and all it was just kind of adorned. There was this garnish of like B-roll footage from the actual film, just kind of gluing it all together. And it was just unbelievably atmospheric. And it had some of Vangelis' music in there as well, but it was also, there was, you know, additional compositions. And my favorite part of the whole game is just your own apartment, where you go back and there's just a balcony, and you click on the balcony, and all you do is like, you can make a coffee and go out there, and it steams. And Vangelis' bluesy, and then flying cars fly past in the smoke, and I was like, "Yeah, this is the game. This is so just evocative." In spite of all of those kind of all of this brokenness and silliness, that's what really, really stuck with me, and that's something that I think adventure games are really good at when they land.
It also allowed you to you got to deliver the Voight Kampff test to people.
Oh, at that was, point, yes,
which was awesome. Although it did, I think, simulate what it would actually be like to deliver the Voight Kampff test, where you're basically sat there asking these questions with a lot of authority, while secretly thinking like, I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing. You know,
yeah, they've got this like really uncomfortably close the Voight Kampff test. If you've not seen the film, it's basically just, you train a small camera on someone's eyeball as they're making their kind of microscopic eye movements.
And ask them oblique questions. Moral questions.
About like, the famous one is like, oh, you're in a desert, you come across a tortoise that's flipped upside down and it can't right itself. What do you do? And then a replica, I suppose, I'm not sure what, like, you could program an AI today to say, oh, I'll just put it back on its thing and feed it some water. But no, a replicant apparently will just be like, yeah, I just eat it, just or eat something. It, yeah. I just scoop out its guts, and then that's me fed. No, but you do that again. The Voight Kampff test is still, through 2D screens, modeled the actual, I don't know, film projector or whatever they jury rigs to actually make that in the film, and then you're staring deep into this character's eyeball, twitching eyeball, as you're asking it questions. That's very, very good.
Very and cool. you get to use the weird camera thing where you can change the angle on a static image.
Yeah, the absolutely magic camera thing, which even in the film I objected
to. Doesn't make sense. Yeah,
it's like, hang on a minute. So zoom, enhance, yeah. And then it goes round a corner, and you see a completely different person. You get to do that as well. Absolute gibberish. Absolute gibberish. Makes no sense.
So my counterpoint to Blade Runner is going to be cardboard computers, Kentucky Route Zero.
Which is
kind of it kind of becomes less and less of a point and click adventure as the chapters go on, because it just gets more and more sad and abstract.
As each
kind of episode, but it certainly starts in that space, and is just a really, again, it, like, this idea of these games as kind of building spaces to spend time in, like, there's nothing like the world that they build in that game anywhere else. Yeah. It's done with like just pure poetry in a way that I think is entirely unique, and I am always like half an eye on what they're going to do next, because, you know, in the same sort of way as something like Grim Fandango, you know, Kentucky Route Zero as a whole is like a real work of art and a real kind of masterpiece of the form. In the same way that I think of like something like, I don't know, House of Leaves or Watchmen as a kind of masterpiece of the form, in that they're just sort of, they're so unique and so full of their own ideas that they carve out their own sort of niche within culture that you can't really put them next to anything else. And yeah, Kentucky Route Zero is just, it's just like a, it feels so real, despite the fact it's a, you know, a game basically built out of very, very obscure metaphors for things that you probably don't know about, like, until you like play the game, or you're a very specific kind of academic on a very specific field, you know. That's my one.
But it has astonishing, like, the music is astonishing. And it's also, it's kind of this kind of melancholic Americana, even if like you don't need to get any references. I don't think it's just sort of sink into that. Kind of like small town, going back home, going on the road, kind of the vibes are real, the vibes are strong, and it's as you say, it's singular, like it couldn't be any other way, like what else. It's just it just is. It's kind of sometimes like really beautiful pieces of creative work just exist, and it's like, well, I'll experience that. It's like you can't, it's hard to criticize because it's just beautiful,
as kids today would say, it's so over. Number two, Monkey Island 2. This is your number two.
My favorite Monkey Island. Most jokes, the best jokes, the best number of characters, the least number of irritating puzzles, as far as I could tell.
It's probably still a fair few.
There are many. Yeah,
what about the spitting competition? Fuck that.
Yeah, damn, that was annoying. but then you do get to sort of, there's also the, remember the guy in the incredibly rich guy in the bed, and you got to set up his tubes to glug in full of there's so many irritating puzzles, but nonetheless, in terms of that world, I don't think that I think that's where you start with Monkey Island. Actually, I think you start with two. I don't think that's all of them have bad puzzles, but I think two is the one that kind of basically recaps the first one very quickly and gets you stuck into the second one, and keeps all the best characters like Stan. And yeah, off you go. It's hard to talk about Monkey Island, really, because it feels like it, people who love PC games just know what it is. But it's a, I should say, it's a sort of a swashbuckling pirate adventure.
It's very good that you start off the game with all of your money that you earned in the first game, which is like almost immediately robbed from you. It's kind of great.
Which is also
just like stacks of gold in your inventory.
Which is also like to be copied by many, many, many dozens of games after that, which give you all your abilities at the start and then take them all away from you. It's often a way to make a game really exciting to start with, but it's done as a joke in this one. Monkey Island 2 is brilliant. It's got Tim Schafer, Ron Gilbert. I think they really balance each other out. Like, Ron Gilbert did like Thimbleweed Park, which is another really fun, very referential adventure game, where essentially you play as the equivalent of Mulder and Scully solving mysterious ghostly crimes in a small town in America. So it's very X-Files inspired, but also it's largely a takedown of the adventure game genre from top to bottom.
Which Ron Gilbert has had it in for them from the start, right?
Despite inventing them
in the first place.
Yes, no, 100%. That's kind of that degree of self-awareness, but tempered with Schafer's exuberance. I think when those two things meet in an adventure game, in those adventure games at that time, I think that was a nice secret sauce. Thimbleweed Park is great, though. It's really, it's not the sort of game that you play as your first adventure game, for sure, because it's so referential. Like, it's very much the center of the entire genre, even though it is good. Like, it's really well made as well. And looks great. It is very much a kind of, you played all these adventure games. I should mention Ben There Done That, actually, as well as another.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. I was going to bring up Ben There Done That. That was, like, the first, like, I mean, obviously there are other examples of it, but like that was the first like out and out indie game I remember sort of playing that was kind of coming out of the UK or whatever, like this adventure game that Dan Marshall made.
Yeah.
And then followed up with Time Gentlemen Please, which also has one of the great opening sequences, which begins the game with them discovering a time machine and like vowing to each other that they're only going to use it for good, not evil, and they're not going to fuck up reality. And then it pans down to, I think, Hitler, like a mecha Hitler with goose-stepping dinosaurs in front of him, which is, yeah, kind of magic.
Those games are immense. And also, I bring them up just because they are joyful send-ups of the genre that are also really fun to play, and the puzzles are really I don't mean stupid in that they're dumb, I mean stupid in the funnest possible way, but you're combining
things. And they wrote like dialogue for everything, like the stupidest possible interactions are worthwhile in that game because written something for basically everything. I need to play their Clockwork God game that they made, which was like a sequel to those, because that sounded good.
Those are great, and those are kind of like, play those before you play Thimbleweed Park. If you play those adventure games and you love them, play the Bend There, Done That games, then play Thimbleweed Park, and that's a great kind of metafictional commentary on the whole genre from start to finish.
My counterpoint to this one is... Marsh said, thank goodness you're here is basically a point and click, and all the better for replacing all the verts with slap, which is true. So my counterpoint to Monkey Island 2 is Simon the Sorcerer 2, The Lion, the Wizard, and the Wardrobe, which is not a good game, I doubt. At the time, I thought it was the best thing that had ever happened in the history of humanity, but I very much doubt it holds up now. However, the comedic premise of it at the time was quite funny. In Simon the Sorcerer 1, you get sent to this kind of, some parody of a fantasy world. There's a great bit at the end of Simon the Sorcerer 1 where you meet a bunch of wizards and orcs and monsters and hobbits who are playing a game that's called something like Lawyers and Accountants instead of Dungeons and Dragons. And you can just stand and watch them do their role-playing game where they're playing that. But Simon the Sorcerer 2 basically takes all of those same characters and says, oh, you're coming back into this world like 30 years later or something, where it's like a parody of like the modern world, essentially. So there's like a skyscraper and there's kind of big business and all that sort of stuff. Nice. All voiced by Chris Barry, who for some reason was everywhere in video games in the mid-90s. Chris Barry of Red Dwarf fame. And now I think like a right-wing conspiracy theorist. I think I've got that right.
That's the end point for so, so many. There's a kind of inevitability to it, isn't there, for some reason?
Yeah. Simon the Sorcerer 2, I doubt, holds up very well now. And there's one bit I remember in it that I think was quite racist in retrospect, but still. At the time, very exciting. And then your number one was Grim Fandango, which we...
It was, and remains so.
It's a very good game.
It's just... I remember it was remastered probably about a decade ago or something. And essentially, it was just basically to get it working on modern machines. And thank goodness they did, because it really should be preserved. They should probably just like put a walkthrough bundled in to get you past the kind of nonsense bits, just because the experience of it is still so fantastic. I think the vocal performance is so brilliant on all the characters as well. It sounds fantastic. I think they're really well directed. I don't know how they were recorded, but like, to me, it's still such a vivid world. And more than anything, even though like much of the joy I've taken in the adventure games we've discussed have been about pushing through the screen of films and things I've seen to go to the next level, this is a thing that doesn't exist in cinema, actually, even though it's still taking, it's borrowing from so many different films and so many different cliches. The world it eventually concocts is its own thing, and I've not experienced anything else that has been so kind of like sardonic and knowing and funny, and just kind of there's a melancholy to it as well as this kind of beautiful sense of humor about death and the journey into the afterlife that I think has stayed with me ever since I played it, and then came back when I played it again and again.
It must be nice for Tim Schafer to have I would say it's almost sounding sarcastic there, but like, created a game that is like can stand alongside, you know, Silent Hill 2 and Shadow of the Colossus, and you know, name your favorite numinous, transcendental video game experience, despite being full of like, you know, gags and stupid jokes about, you know, whatever the hell, you know, it's kind of, it's a very funny game, and yet still kind of stands among kind of, you know, deeply humorless games like that, you know, in the kind of pantheon of great games, isn't it?
But I think the epitome of it for me is like the idea of sprouting flowers is the ultimate death in the dead world that you occupy. And there's just such a fantastic line about pushing up flowers that it's just such a dark joke. I felt like all the good jokes went in, and so many of them are gold. And like the characterization is so good. And when characters choose to get bored of you as a player that is just badgering them, which is also another thing that adventure games have to do, because you're talking to everyone relentlessly,
constantly
over and
annoying
again.
Everyone. Yeah,
yeah. Those lines are really funny. It's his own thing. I think. Yeah, it's weird to put it alongside. It's not weird to put it alongside. I agree with you, putting it alongside stuff like Shadow of the Colossus, and like that is a video game thing. That is just singularly a video game thing. Like it exists in that medium and is perfect within.
Yeah, those rules. And they're just these like spaces that people carry around with them for the rest of their lives. Essentially, it's amazing, really. All right, should we stop? Should we stop nattering about adventure games now and get back to the point and click adventure that is our real lives?
it feels like a point and click adventure at the moment. It's going to be like click on fridge, click on ice pack. I've got cold pack. I've got in there. Find out Emma's taking it. Oh, it's gone. Some sort of elaborate. I'm going to have to obviously forge a moustache in order to break into a local police station in order to gain a key that I can use to then forge one. And so on and so forth forever.
I feel like there was something very comforting about a big list of verbs at the bottom of the screen, all of which that could have been easily replaced by like use. You know, it took so long for them to work out that you could just go by context and just clicking on an item and clicking on an object would be fine. You didn't have to specify whether it was push or pull.
I don't understand. Like, I would love to know how that happened, because I don't understand how. You know, sit there and look at it, and it's like, okay, let's just give the player loads of verbs, and they can use all these verbs on everything. But each verb you add creates like an exponential number of extra dialogue or like messages that you need to write to say no, you can't actually.
Yeah, all of which to say no. And it must be from the era where, like, you know, the Space Quests and the King's Quests and the Leisure Suit Larry's, where they would have a text parser where you would have your items, you'd type items, and it would give you a list of what you had. And then you had to like be really specific about what you wanted to do. And so in the LucasArts games in particular, they were like, oh, we're going to take away that level of friction by just like spelling out 9 different verbs for you, which will cover more or less everything.
No one was like, could we just do it in 2?
Yeah.
Because like in those old adventure games, I bet about 90 to 95% of all of the dialogue in it or all of the messages the player is given is like, you can't do this.
Yeah.
It's just saying no to the player because the limits are so, so firmly drawn. It's not a simulation. There is one very stupid, precise way through this to get to the next scene.
Yeah. I think it was Full Throttle, which was the first one to have a kind of very like badass metal context sensitive thing where it was like fists, feet, you know, mouth, and then there was another one too.
That's good.
And that kind of, that was pretty awesome.
That's also just great for jokes. Like,
Yeah. Like the first puzzle in that game is you're trying to work out how to like get the bartender to give you your keys. And you realize that the only way you can do it is to duff him up by using your fists on him, which is kind of great. All right. Well, that is all the podcasting we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening. You can hang out with us on our community, on our Discord channel, a link for which is on our website, www.crateandcrowbar.com. If you want to send us some questions, we are going to do some questions sometime soon. You can send it to us via the question subchannel on said Discord, or you can email it to us at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. We're also on YouTube at youtube.com/crateandcrowbar. Crate and Crowbar is very kindly funded by our Patreon backers. If you'd like to know more about supporting our podcast and its various spin-offs, patreon.com/crateandcrowbar. And we are also on Blue Sky now at crateandcrowbar.bisky.social. That's it. That's everything. Thank you very much for listening. Tom, I hope you have a lovely week.
Likewise, Jamie. Likewise. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.